This is a very great treat to have Andrew speaking this morning, although he's been here all week, and I hope many of you have visited his workshop, really, up towards the Henge. And also, it's quite sort of fitting for a Sunday morning to be thinking about churches when this whole village would have been flooding into the village church less than 100 years ago. And they still do go, but not quite in those numbers. So such a part of our fabric, the churches, the stonemasons, the cathedrals. And I'm really looking forward to hearing more about it. And the curious, it's called the curious story of Britain's churches. So I have to work out why that's curious.
Yeah, there's some pornography in it.
Anyway, so thank you all for coming, and I hope you've been here for several days of the week, and there's lots on today, so I hope you're going to really enjoy your visit to the festival. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Penny.
Andrew will be signing the book in the Waterstones tent. It's an absolute treasure trove of information, and he'll be in the big Waterstones tent at the end.
Thank you. Wow. It's like the start of boxing bouts, you know, but I'm not glamorous in any way. Certainly not after being here for a week. So thanks for coming. This is a good turnout for a Sunday morning, isn't it? I'm surprised and delighted. So great. I've been a stonemason for 35 years, and as I got into my 50s, I thought, right, I need to find another way to increase my earnings. And I'd read that becoming an author is a way to not actually do that. So I thought I'd crack on anyway. But I keep getting really great advances to write books. So I'm just going to keep churning them out. So I've written two now. And I'm really, really pleased with how churchgoing's gone. It's sold 13,000 copies so far. So I'm getting more than a pound a copy. So that's all right. The artwork on the cover that you can see was created by Claire, my wife, and it's cut out paper overlaid. And the characters along the bottom, the saints, it's just coincidental that there's a chap with a beard. There's a young female saint with long blonde hair and a whippet. Oh, and my wife as well, you know. So off we go. So much of what we do is pure conservation. I'm not at the top of a tower cutting out gargoyles and grotesques and recarving new ones. It's about conserving the original fabric of the building in situ. But every now and again, if it's a weathering or a pinnacle or something that's been blown out by a cast iron cramp, you have to get more involved. So with this feature that you're looking at here, this is a pinnacle. And the problem with pinnacles is that Victorian restorers would take out the original cast iron cramps, which don't tend to corrode quite as readily, and replace them with... Did I say cast iron? Replace them. They took out the wrought iron cramps, the blacksmith-made cramps, which are of a higher quality, and replaced them with cast iron. And cast iron, Victorian cast iron, is not great, and it expands and exerts tremendous pressures within the stonework. So this pinnacle here at Castle Coombe in North Wiltshire, you can see it's slightly on the lean, and all of those stones that run up through have been riven apart by expanding cast iron. You didn't think you're going to be hearing about this when you signed up, did you? So we've replaced some sections, we've conserved some sections, we've carved a new finial on the top. And we earn quite a lot of our living. We're just a tiny company. And we just go from job to job, just repairing individual features like this, replacing iron cramps, if we can, that the Victorians have put in. And taking out inappropriate cements and conserving in situ. So that the picture on the side is Spike, our first sight dog. He was great. He could climb a scaffold ladder. I've never met a dog that could do that before. And then he would just come up and stand on top of the tower like whippets do, just like that. But it nearly led to his undoing when a bitch on heat walked past and off he went. Broken legs, but he survived. So, as I say, look, there's a pinnacle in the background there. So the pinnacle that Spike is in is a Cornish granite pinnacle. That's a church at Luffincott just over the Tamar, this side of the Tamar in Devon. And because it's granite, it just doesn't need any work at all. The Victorians would have wouldn't have had to intervene in that whatsoever. And I did have a little dig around, and there the actual component that holds the pinnacle to the top of the church tower, if you like, is a long lozenge of granite. So much better than, you know, steel or metal. Here we go. So this is a current project. Well, we finished it a couple of weeks ago. This is at Bitton, just outside of Bristol. And a question I always get at the end of this talk is, you know, the Church of England seems to be in a real state, doesn't it? And our churches seem to be in a bit of a state. And everywhere we go, I meet church wardens and enthusiastic people who are just determined to keep their churches going. So I personally think the story is not as bleak as the newspapers would have us believe. So this is a case in point here at Bitton, as I say, just outside of Bristol, where this very strong team of local people were determined to bring the church into greater community use. And the first stage of that is to actually give it a clean. I'd heard on the grapevine that they wanted to give it a clean by shot blasting the interior. So I got in touch with the architect and said, I got in touch. There's always a pecking order. You don't talk to the church warden first. You go and talk to the architect, you know. But I talked to the church warden and said, I think we need some advice, if you don't mind me saying. So we cleaned the walls. We removed the pollutants from the walls with this latex material that they'd been using at Notre Dame. And I put a video of this, you know, you paint it on, it smells like copy decks, you know, that old fishy stuff we all remember from when you were all younger. You paint it on the wall. It's got a chemical compound called ammonium carbonate in it, and it converts the carbon dirt on the surface, and it makes it easy to draw off. So I put a video on Instagram. There's going to be a couple of Instagram references here, so I hope you're all up to speed with the tech. And 2 million people have watched this video of us pulling the latex off. It's really bizarre. People are odd, aren't they? And it's come up really fantastically, and we're up for an award on that. So this is an unusual job for us, but it's fairly typical. What I love about this job is that it's got a bit of everything here. It's an Anglo-Saxon minister church on the foundations and the lower wall, and then the walls go up, and then there's later Norman windows, and those Norman windows have been punctured with later Gothic windows. So you've got everything going on in there. I won't drone on too much about the features, the interesting chantry chapel that it's got, but maybe I will later. Anyway, there you go. Notre Dame had some criticism because it was thought that they'd clean their walls a bit too much with this latex product. But the problem that they had that we didn't have was that their walls were completely saturated with lead particulate. So that's not something you want to leave in the pores of your walls for, you know, forever. So they had to go a bit deeper with the cleaning the latex walls, which, as I say, we didn't have that problem. There we go. The chancel arch has come up really nicely. This is a Victorian reproduction of a Victorian idea, a Victorian enhancement of a Norman chancel arch. So that's a fairly typical project. As I say, we just go from job to job. I like to think we have the best life. My workmate Peter's here, so I'm just looking at him. Oh, he's nodding his head. Yes. Phew. Unbelievably, Peter and I are next door neighbours and workmates. And after all these years, we're still getting on, aren't we? Yes, good. So why are churches where they are? I think we can all have a good guess on this. The first churches were established by the early saints and missionary workers on sites that were considered to be sacred by the populations that were living in these areas. So that could be a holy well, it could be a sacred tree, it could be a standing stone. And this is my favorite example of that that comparison. This is the great monolith at Rudston in the East Riding of Yorkshire. And you can see how the chancel of the church has just been plonked next to it. It's astonishing that it survived, but it obviously had an important potency to local people. You know, they respected it. I came to a talk here on Wednesday about Chalk Hill figures. Did any of you come to that? It was so fantastic. And the main theme of that was the silent, unrecorded handing on of the scouring of these places that has occurred for, you know, in the case of the Uffington White Horse, it's occurred for thousands of years. It's just and that's a marvel to me that we're all our people are just through the centuries have been doing that. And I think local people have been protecting monuments like this. Rudston has a really interesting place name. Rudston, it means rude stone or cross stone. Rude comes from the old Anglo-Saxon word for cross. And I was long suspected that underneath the lead cap that's there, there's a socket to accommodate a cross. But it's amazing to me that the locals haven't knocked that down and used it as a quarry, you know, because, you know, to build the chancel. The early saints is all about, the stories of the early saints is all about them, you know, destroying groves and converting holy wells and cutting down standing stones, you know. But the first saint who came here would have, you know, just carved a likeness of the cross in there or maybe planted a cross in the top. So I think that lead cap is protecting a socket. And then I was on Instagram the other day and I saw this. Da-da. This is in Brittany, a menhir of similar size. Fantastic. So I'm, as usual, I'm right. The glories of social media, eh? Early churches in the western part of the country would have generally been established in a circular enclosure called a llan, if you're in Wales, or a lan if you're in Cornwall. This old church here is near, I'm not going to try and pronounce that, I apologise. My Welsh pronunciation isn't great. But when I was reading my audio book, I did learn to say Llanfaith Pilgwingith Gegerith Thindrobith Llantai Siliach o Gogoch, which is, you meant to clap now, is it? which is a fair approximation, I think. Sorry to any native Welsh speakers out there. So you'll generally have a church in the middle of this circular enclosure, and the llan place name that is so familiar to us as we travel around Wales, just means an enclosure. It's similar to lawn, if you think about it. It's just an enclosed space around a church. So if I see a circular churchyard and I'm driving past and I'm in Wales or Cornwall or going to Ireland, you know, the handbrake's on and I'm going to have a look. It's not quite the case in Ireland, where many of the early missionaries came from. They don't really have this circular enclosure feel, but they have these fortified sites called rounds, and they think that's where this idea came from. But I very often say to Violet, who's sat in the row, you know, grinning, Violet's been helping me all week and she's bloody amazing. You know, she's been carving this wonderful tree of life. But yeah, come and have a look afterwards and I'll tell you about what we're doing. So I said to Violet, do you want to go and take off and go look at some shrines? Yeah. Off we went. So we went to this is at Temple Cronan in the Burren. This is a stone church, a single cell church that replaced an earlier wooden structure. But we went there to see the two tent shrines either side. You can see the two, they just look like old fashioned, you know, scout or girl guide tents, ridge tents. There it is, amazing thing. And the saint is still in there. And local people go and visit this place and they go with offerings from the beach. They bring shells up and little coins and flowers from their garden. and they just put them inside. It's just, oh, you know, it's this continuation again, isn't it? I absolutely love that. So the east end of the church, oh, the west end of the church, sorry, that you can see there, just built from great big chunks of stone that have been extracted and laid together in a sort of drywall fashion. And you can see the quarry is just straight there. And that's something you can see with quite a lot of early churches, that there will be a juxtaposition between the quarry and the church if the church hasn't really evolved. I'll talk to you about another one in a minute. So the first saints, the early missionaries, they would plant a timber cross. The timber cross would be replaced with a stone cross. And this cross here at Rothall in Dumfries and Galloway is where I got into churches as a kid. Every year I was a pain in the arse, and I get packed off by my mum to her cousin's farm, which was near this. And after a day of hard labour, Uncle John would take me off in his tractor to go and look at Robert the Bruce's cave or a Roman mile station. Or one day he said, let's go and look at the Viking runes at the nearby church. I thought, Viking runes, this is okay. So we turned up, and I remember I was about 8, 9. I remember walking into this church, and it's had such a profound effect on me. I think about this place every day. It's astonishing. Walked into this church, and it's like, you know, like in 2001, you know, and there's the stone and all the lights are on. And it just sort of, Uncle John turned the lights on. This thing sort of shrunk in on itself. It's so colossal that it's too tall for the church, and it's built into a pit in the ground. So even though this is in Scotland, this is in Northumbrian Scotland. This is Anglo-Saxon Scotland. And this high cross was carved in the 8th century. So it's got the general depictions of cartoons, if you like, of Christ's life. And around this depiction of his 40 days and 40 nights in the desert, there's a Latin inscription that explains that. On the side, you know, you can see the vine, the tree of life, as I am the vine and you are the branches, and you can see the creatures feeding on the goodness that's provided by Christianity in the form of grapes. But around the side of that are the Viking runes. And I picked up the ping pong thing that all these great churches have, and only to read that they weren't Viking runes, they're Anglo-Saxon runes. So the Anglo-Saxons are not Vikings, are they? I'm not interested. Anyway, the inscription around here is the earliest inscribed poem in the English language. It's a poem called The Dream of the Rood, and it depicts the suffering of Christ from the point of view on the cross that he's been nailed to. There it is, the earliest English poem, not written into a manuscript, but cut into the old red sandstone of Galloway. Anyway, it was buried by the Covenanters in the 16th century, and it had a couple of hundred years underground, and that sort of saved it, really. So they put it back up in the church. Well, they built a church around it. But yeah, I love this thing. I love it so much that we're sort of, Violet and I have been creating an interpretation of this in on our little stand over there. But along the top, are there any Anglo-Saxon readers here, runic readers? Oh, that's good. I could tell you anything. Along the top, it says Donald Trump is... It actually says... No, it doesn't. Christ. See that first word? That actually says Christ, doesn't it? You can see that. Christ was on the rood. Christ was on the cross. And off it goes. The only thing that's missing is the word what, you know, that Beowulf begins with. Lots of Anglo-Saxon poetry, but I think that might not have been appropriate if they were inscribing that into the stonework. So this is the earliest church I've worked on. This is St. Lawrence's in Bradford-on-Avon. And the quarry, as I was saying about the earlier church in Ireland. What is that? It's annoying, yeah. Yeah. This is a two-cell church. Oh, that worked, yeah. This is a two-cell church So the first churches, the first saints' chapels, whatever you want to call them, were a single-cell structure. And then as they were built in stone, they would extend into a two-cell structure. These late Anglo-Saxon churches had a feature on either side called a porticus. And there was a side chapel in there as well. And that reflects a Roman domestic dwelling where there would always be an altar on the side adjacent to where you enter the door. But the quarry is still there, just behind this church. So when we were repairing the corner of the porticus, pulled the stonework out, there'd been a bit of a collapse. And I could just smell the river in there. It was really funky. I thought, what's this? And the core of this structure has been built with clay dug out from the adjacent riverbank of the River Avon and just knocked up, and they glued the stones together that way. And this, you know, this structure has been standing since about the year 1000. It's absolutely astonishing, and it's still there, just held together. Massive blocks of stone held together with clay. And we've discovered that this tradition of construction, we discover things all the time. It's really great. Pete discovered a really great thing that you're going to see in a minute. We discovered that the Kennet and Avon Canal, which flows nearby, all the bridges and the abutments on the canal itself are just blocks of stone bedded on clay. And it's the same on the adjacent Norman church that, for some reason, you can see just see the spire of it behind has been built in a far more inferior site to the Anglo-Saxon church. Might have been a royal shrine of some sort. I'm not too sure. But it's an absolute wonder. And it's important because early churches at that time were generally built from reused Roman material. Certainly the case in the northeast or along Hadrian's Wall. I'm sure many of you have been to Jarrow. And this was built like off plan by a team of masons who came in, extracted the stone from the quarry behind, just didn't build in a sort of rubbish dry stone wall. They built it in a formal Roman way. And I think it's one of the most important buildings in the country, and it's just up the road, you know. So this is my favourite church. This is Kilpeck in Herefordshire. I bet many of you have been there. Do many of you know what's coming? Yeah, okay, there's a bit of rudeness coming, maybe. Kilpeck is a three-cell church, nave, chancel, and an apse at the end. It's famous for its carving. Again, this old red sandstone, which is completely indestructible. And what's so interesting about the carving here is that the individual that commissioned this was a true internationalist. In this work, you can see much of it is Islamic in origin. There's a huge Scandinavian influence there, obviously Anglo-Saxon and Norman influence. Basically, every art historical story that was occurring in Europe in the 12th century can be seen here. It's absolutely astonishing. So I love that place. And again, its story of survival is down to the durability of the stone. The carving here is excellent. But it's got this famous corbel table that runs around the edge that supports prevents the roof from pushing out too much. So you've got all these cutesy animals and lion's heads. The carving's not particularly, I mean, it's okay, but it's nothing compared to the doorway. And then you've got the Sheila and a gig at the end, which I'm not going to try and interpret what she means to you. But again, I think she was protected by local people. You know, she couldn't have survived the Civil War and reform-minded incumbents and just the general drift of history without the local people, you know, wanting to protect her. So I think she was probably important to expectant mothers and that sort of thing. You know, she was a point of devotion. Just to balance it out, there are going to be some willies later. So so these corbels, as we get into the sort of main part of the medieval period, these turned into grotesques and gargoyles. So these grotesque figures here are Winchcombe. They're amongst the best I know, Winchcombe in Gloucestershire. And the guy with the funny hat on, is that him? No, the guy at the end, next to the chute. He's meant to be the stonemason that carved it. There's always a stonemason there. But he's holding a dummy in his hand. Well, I think it's quite convincing, isn't it? You know, if you give it a, yeah. But, you know, they're all interpreting local characters and some of the townspeople of the late 14th century. Right. So again, a fairly typical job. We do lots of church towers. This was our great lockdown project at Hemington. This is for the Church's Conservation Trust. And when a church is deemed to be considered to be redundant, it's gifted to the Church's Conservation Trust, who do incredible things with very, very little money. But the Church of England does have a fund to pay for repairs, so it's handed out. These places are handed over in good order. So this was our lockdown project, and because the architect couldn't visit that often, it was, you know, it was just great. We could just get on with it. But there's a good architect here. Here we are, typical working platform. You can see stone on the trestle there. We're trying to keep the main body of the stone, but the weathering, the drip that sheds water away from the body of the tower, it's important that is replaced. So we've inserted a new piece of stone there. These sort of high Gothic medieval structures had flying buttresses. This is at Steeple Ashton in Wiltshire. And you can see the buttresses that go down to the ground. This is on the roof of the aisle. And there's this sort of toothed out section. And you can see the there's one left at the end. It's a better view from up the tower. What happened here is that this Steeple Ashton did have a spire. And the spire came down in a storm as there were two stonemasons working on it. Obviously, they had a, you know, they came to a terrible end, and they buried them under the floor of the north porch. A bit gruesome. I always feel a bit for them, you know, when we walk over that space. But the spire went down. It went through the nave roof. The nave roof was formerly built of stone slates, and that was replaced with lead. And lead, believe it or not, is actually a far lighter material than stone slates per square meter. So all of a sudden, the flying buttresses that are designed to stop the wall space between the windows from pushing out were pushing the walls in. So they made the decision to take them out 300 years ago, and it's still working correctly. Didn't need an engineer then. It just went. Rrr. So fairly typical work of ours. Where we are repairing the window mullions with a lime putty mortar. There's a bit of stone replacement, but we generally try and conserve as much original material as possible. Oh yeah, here's one of the grotesque figures. I mean, what are they for? I mean, you can see, look at the size of my fat head compared to this character. But these grotesque and these grotesques and gargoyles had a purpose, and that was to we all gargle, don't we? And gargoyles project water via a spout away from the body of the tower. And grotesque figures have an apotropaic purpose. They're designed to ward away spirits determined to enter the church with evil intent. This is my interpretation, and I think it's pretty good. I mean, this doesn't look very scary, does it? But when you reflect on the true horror of what she actually is, it's you know, if you're one of Harry Potter's Dementors and you're swooning around outside the church and you're confronted with her, you're not going to try and break in via the window, are you? Or, you know, so you see these apotropate devices all over the church. I'll just say she was a bit tired on top. She had a bowl of water that would form all the time, so there's freeze-thaw action going on. So we made a nice lead hat for her, nice crown, and, you know, she'll be good to go for another 500 years or so. But these apotropate devices, these devices designed to ward away spirits determined to enter the church with evil intent, you can see examples of this all over the church. I'm sure many of you know about this type of graffiti with daisy wheels, where the idea is that if you're a demon, you would see this compass work and you would be drawn into it, and you'd be drawn into it and you would just circulate around it forever. And you find this graffiti absolutely everywhere. Cathedrals, churches, cow buyers, tithe barns, that the group on the right-hand side, I don't know what, I can't see what you can see. Anyway, the group on the right-hand side is from the Great Tithe Barn in Bradford-on-Avon, and it's awash with these daisy wheels. The lower central collection there, all completely different. They're not Mason's marks. They definitely have a folk magic purpose. That's at the Rosalind Chapel, just south of Edinburgh. And you find it cut into all sorts of church furniture as well. This is a parish chest, a 14th century parish chest. You can just see a bit of the original paint there. You can see this daisy wheel design. It's probably not quite as effective as the three locks that it's got on it for the two church wardens and the incumbent. There we go. Can you see what that is? Yeah, you see these things everywhere. Churches are full of willies. This is at St. Stephen's in Bristol. You go up the stairwell of St. Stephen's, and by all of the openings, the doors into the bell chamber, the windows, these are cut into the walls. I'm sure many of you have been to Pompeii. Every house at Pompeii has one of these fellas outside, doesn't he? You know, as a good luck mark. Here's a collection of them that we found on the roof at Hemington, our lockdown church. JM, he was quite enthusiastic. I won't dwell on that, yeah. So our lead worker, Andy Jones, he's got some family members buried in the graveyard at Hemington. He didn't want to put it, he cut it out because obviously it's important to keep them, but he didn't want to put them back in the place that they came out of. So he's put them in a new position in the north, on the north slope by the tower on the dark side where, he thought they were just people being idiots and they weren't trying to protect the church with introducing this type of graffiti. Again, at Hemington, Peter on the front row, second to front row, he noticed something in the little hole of this little niche here. This is a feature called a piscina. And a piscina is where the vessels of the Eucharist are washed. So if you literally have the blood and the body of Christ as a residue, you can't just like wash it out in the churchyard. You have to dispose of and clean these vessels appropriately. So every pre-Reformation church in an area adjacent to an altar, there will be one of these features. It's got a drain hole in the bottom, and this drain hole is called a sacrarium. Anyway, it's a sacred drain, and this drain will go into the area under the altar, so it's protected and made safe. But Peter noticed something glinting in the top. Is this a fair assessment, Pete? But so there was about an inch below the hole. And because Peter's got everything he needs for work in his van, he had one of these drain, things. He started pulling out all this stuff. Glass, bent pins. People put bent pins into holy wells, don't they? Well, they used to, in Cornwall that was a thing, to cure eye complaints. Buttons, tokens, and this gold. You see that gold lozenge there? That's quite a find. But it's not gold. It's plastic-coated gold, plastic. It's plastic gold, and on it is a likeness of Our Lady of Guadalupe, a very important saint in Central America, and she'd been placed there obviously in the last 10 years or something. So I love it that a visitor from Mexico has gone to this rural, proper rural church, paid their respect, seen the piscina, and made their own small devotional act in this space. I'd love to ask them what they were actually doing and what it meant to them. But anyway, you don't want to mess with whatever juju's going on here. So everything went back in the hole. It was all recorded, and I think there's a good doctorate waiting to be done for someone to investigate the contents of piscina drain pipes. I've had a poke around in a few since this time, and they've all got something interesting in them. Lots of glass as well. pre-Reformation glass, smashed out, pushed in the hole. You know, what were they trying to keep out? Or what they're trying to keep in? I don't know. Something really interesting going on there. But this this desire to ward away spirits from entering your church with evil intent doesn't always work, okay? So this is I refer to this church in my first book, and it's in a place called Holmstoke, which doesn't exist. It's the place of my favourite Thomas Hardy short story, because the insurance claim for this project was a bit iffy, so I didn't want to, not from our part, but on the parish's part. So I just wanted to not involve them too much. So the architect phoned up and said, Andrew, a window's fallen out at Holmstoke. Can you come in and, sort it out? There was a tone of anxiety in his voice. And when I was driving down the street, I nearly turned around and went home when I saw this. Gust of wind, act of God, that caused this window to fall out. So perhaps the grotesques and gargoyles and the apotropaic devices were actually working here, because there was a mother and toddlers group taking place at that point. And if it had fallen in, it would have been absolutely, well, it would have been horrible, obviously. So we shored everything up. We established what we could save. We created new mullions to support the rose window. We created two new sections of rose window. We could salvage quite a lot of what was there. There it is going back, and then with the new glazing in. But the real problem, it wasn't an act of God. It was an act of incompetence by an earlier builder, because they put some plate glass doors in underneath. They put an I-beam in underneath the window, and that caused everything just to drop by about 5 millimetres. And that they'd done this work about 4 months before, and it just had enough. It just came out, you know. So, jobbing builders. Wrongs we have written. So, the Reformation. One of the motivations for me writing my book, well, I'll be doing a signing afterwards, £25, helps to pay for our daughter's university, thank you. Just keep finding amazing things left over from the Reformation, but from before the Reformation. And I love this work of propaganda here that you can see. So Henry's on his deathbed. He's handing on the reins of the Protestant Reformation to his son, Edward. And Edward's advised by his uncles, Cranmer, all people who were really against the old ways. So they just wanted to destroy shrines, destroy statuary, whitewash over walls. The act of destruction that took place in the 1540s, 50s and 60s was just, it's like the Taliban. It was just incredible. Think how rich and beautiful our churches would have been. It's quite funny, the Pope's being crushed by an English Bible. well, it's not funny, it's, weird. But in the corner, you can see a likeness. Look, you see there's a church cross, and they're pulling down the statuary. You know, that's the injunction of 1547 just said, destroy everything, basically. Why is that there? I don't know. I'll gloss over that. So all shrines were destroyed. All shrines. There was only one shrine left in situ that's got the saints, the bones of the original saint in. Isn't that right? Whitchurch Canonicorum, yeah, in Dorset, not far from the road. And this is our most potent native saint, and she's still in there. This is a later reconstruction of a shrine of the 1250s or so. Some people try and correct me by saying, oh, but what about the royal shrine of Edward the Confessor in Westminster Abbey? Well, that's been moved. So, okay, don't cross me on that one. So the only shrine that's left, and she's in there. But in so many other places, bits of shrine have been discovered, built into walls or church, you know, the clan wall going around, and put back together. The rather grander shrine that you can see, this is at Pennant Malangle in Wales, in a very, very remote and romantic mountainous part of Wales. This shrine was destroyed during the Reformation, but the restorers put everything back together, and anything that was missing, they made it in concrete of a slightly different colour, and it just works. And where the fabled place of burial for the actual saint, Saint Malangle, was purported to be when they were building the extension, they found the bones of a young woman of similar age. So she's been placed in there. So I find that, I don't have a particular faith, but you can't not be affected by these places and their deep history, and their deep-rooted history. 5 minutes. Wow, okay. I've been going on too much for now. I'm sorry. Okay. My favourite piece of church art, this is the great Jesse at Abergavenny in St Mary's in Abergavenny. And he is the size of a rhinoceros. He's lying on his arm, and it's a wonder to me, because most medieval church sculpture was in wood, and obviously it was all just burnt during the Reformation. But he survived, and he's astonishing. When he was built, he was hollowed out on the inside and whitewashed, so he didn't warp and twist too much. He's, as I say, he's one of my favorite characters. Jesse was the ultimate ancestor of the Holy Family. His son was King David, and there are many depictions of him in glass in North Wales. The locals refer to this example. Gives you an idea of the intensity of colour that was around in the medieval church. The locals refer to him as Jesse on the telephone, which it's like, oh yeah, blood clot. He's all right. But this is my favourite piece of church art I've seen anywhere. It's the carving. These are my two favourite depictions of Christ. The wall painting is a depiction of the Sunday Christ, and this is how Christ would suffer if you were to ignore the Sabbath, a sort of warning to Sabbath breakers, if you like. And he's, you know, his body is lacerated with this gruesome array of late medieval agricultural implements. There's a playing card there as well that you can see by his elbow, and a scythe. It's a very, when you're confronted by it, it's absolutely colossal. It's a very shocking image even now. But the figure on the left is the Mercer's Hall Christ, which was only discovered, it was buried face down during the Reformation. It was only discovered after the Blitz, when the chapel at Mercer's Hall in the City of London had been bombed. And I was talking about this the other day, and I met a really wonderful old lady who'd been to see this when it had been discovered. You know, she was like six, seven, 8 years old. And she said it was covered in paint. It was absolutely dripping with original paint, and they scrubbed it off. It's like, oh, so close, you know. But whoever carved this, I mean, look at his eyelids, his tongue slightly sticking out. And the character who was sent to destroy this image, so this is an image of Christ's deposition from the cross. He's laid out, he's in a shroud. He bashed off his crown of thorns, but he couldn't bring himself to destroy his face. I could just imagine him just pausing at that point. So they just flipped him over and that. How much time have I got? Minute? I've got time here. Sorry, I don't need to ask. I've got 2 minutes. Right, okay. So images of Christ were completely destroyed. Every church would have had one. They were all... Every single one was destroyed, and all you find now are just bits. But rood screens, this division between the nave and the chancel, the Reformed Church decided to keep them there. So you can get a glimpse as to the into the wondrous world of late medieval art. by going looking at rood screens in East Anglia, and the West Country. So this is my favourite one. This is at St Helens at Ranworth. Look at the beauty and the colour palette at work there. It's just incredible. And rood screens would generally have a depiction of this saint here, Saint Apollonia. And she's great. Well, I mean, poor thing. She was tortured to death by having her teeth drawn out. But she's the patron saint of toothache and dentists. And because of, you know, folk medicine, if you had raging toothache, you would go and see her and you would touch your face up to her. And you know, you can go to any rood screen in the country and do that if you've got toothache. I haven't tried it personally, but imagine going into the Victoria and Albert Museum and trying that, one of their artworks. So there we go. Oh, 28 seconds, right. There we go. Here's the Doom painting. Here we are working below it to repair the piers of the crossing. But every point of transition in a church would likely have had one of these depictions of the Day of Judgment. And they're incredibly formulaic, but varied in quality. So you always have Christ sat on a rainbow, accompanied by the sun and the moon. He's showing his wounds. He shall come with wounds red to judge the quick and the dead. And those who are to be saved are going off to meet St. Peter on one side, and obviously more entertainingly on the gruesome left side, all those that are damned, including bishops, which is quite satisfying, are being drawn into this hellmouth by a couple of demons with a chain. Oh, I've gone over by 30 seconds. That I reckon that'll do, won't it? Thank you.